All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and the date is the 18th of November, and we're going to finish up the cardiovascular chapter. All right, you guys, you're going to have to come to order or go outside in the hallway or something so we don't disturb everybody else that's sort of listening. All right, so you guys had a test last time, graded. Your grades are in Blackboard. Unless I didn't see a picture ID, and then a bunch of people are going to show me their picture ID later and you'll get your grades. And I've updated 3 of the 4 lab sections to include all of your current quizzes. And I'll get the other section done this afternoon. And then you'll know exactly what grade you have going in the class. Okay? So the drop date is this week sometime for you guys. And I think I get to drop people until maybe Sunday. I'm not sure. Either Saturday night or Sunday. I'm not sure what the deal is with that. Okay, so don't drop the class if you're getting an 89%. Okay, please. I know a lot of you probably will, but anyway, that's just a little plea. I don't know. I suppose if you have an 89% and you want to drop the class, you can drop the class if you want to. Okay, so we're talking about in this chapter, intrinsic mechanisms that control the heart and extrinsic mechanisms that control the heart. And what's the intrinsic mechanism called? The intrinsic. Intrinsic means that it's just a natural property of the heart. Doesn't need any innervation, doesn't need hormones. And it's named after two people. The Frank Starling Law of the Heart. Right, that just says as the heart expands, what happens to contractility? What happens to contractility of heart muscle as the sarcomeres are stretched? It gets stronger. That's right. So as more blood is presented, at least in the normal heart, and that's very important to remember, in the normal heart, as the heart fills with blood during diastole, it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And if for some reason you have more venous return at a particular time, more blood is presented to the heart, the heart muscle gets stronger and is able to pump that additional blood throughout your body. All right, so that's intrinsic. And then we have extrinsic. That requires what? The parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system or hormonal influences. And that's kind of what we were talking about last time. I suppose we could review parasympathetic and sympathetic. But what's the effect of parasympathetic stimulation on the heart? Where does it go, first of all? Where does the parasympathetic nerves go? To the SA node and the AV node. So what does the parasympathetic nervous system control in the heart? Is it chronotropy or inotropy or both? Okay, parasympathetic just controls chronotropy, just the heart rate, because it only goes to the SA node and AV node. Doesn't affect contractility. All right, now what about sympathetic innervation? Yeah, it's both of them, because sympathetic goes to the SA node, the AV node, as well as the ventricular muscle. So it controls both the chronotropy and inotropy of the heart, increasing heart rate and increasing force of contraction. All right, so you can see that the Frank Starling Law and sympathetic response kind of mimic each other. They go hand in hand by increasing cardiac output. Oh, and I suppose maybe I should write that equation down on the board, right? So blood flow is something that we measure as what? Cardiac output, CO. That's cardiac output. And what the heck is cardiac output? It is what? Milliliters per minute. And it is equal to some very basic parameters of the heart, namely what? We say stroke volume, right, which is mLs per beat, times heart rate, which is what? Beats per minute. All right, so that's a blood flow. We're going to come back to that equation a bunch in this chapter. Okay, so the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure in the long term, day to day, week to week, you know, during a month, course of a month or so, is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system right here. And we went over this last time. Does anybody have any questions about this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism for controlling heart rate? All right, so probably you should be able to draw this out and not just label it, but actually draw it out, make sure you know all the interconversions that are happening here. And then when you see something like angiotensinogen, you should know something about that molecule, like what? It is inactive, right? And then you should know here, renin is an enzyme that converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. And then here's another enzyme. All right, so some of these interconversion steps are controlled by enzymatic reactions. I don't know what I did. But I know who was here before me. They were using a DVD player or something. Okay. But from here, I think you only can control both of them at one time. So you might have to go in the back there. Yeah. Okay, so we'll carry on and have fun. All right, so make sure you're familiar with this. Now, this right here, we're talking about aldosterone, right, as what? Increasing low blood pressure. There were two other hormones that we talked about. So there were three. Let's think of the three that we started out with. The first one was from the posterior pituitary called antidiuretic hormone. Okay, antidiuretic hormone, decreased urine volume, which increases blood volume, that increases blood pressure. Right, that action is similar to aldosterone. All right, so ADH and aldosterone are synergistic. They work a little bit differently, of course, but they are synergistic. They both increase blood pressure. All right, and then what was the last one? Atrial natriuretic hormone. All right, so that is a hormone, not an enzyme, that is released from what organ? The heart, in particular, the atria. And natriuretic means what? It has an effect on sodium, because that's natrium. It causes what? The secretion of sodium into the kidney tubule then, which is lost as urine. And as sodium goes into the kidney tubule, so does water volume, right? And so that has a tendency to do the opposite of aldosterone and antidiuretic hormone. So that has a tendency to decrease blood pressure when that happens. All right, so that's what we're talking about right now. We're just finishing up the antagonistic hormone, which is atrial natriuretic hormone, to what? Aldosterone and ADH. All right, so expanded blood volume is detected by stretch receptors in the left atrium and causes release of ANP. ANP inhibits aldosterone, right? It's antagonistic to it. Promotes salt and water excretion to lower blood volume. And when blood volume decreases, there's less venous return. So what happens to the heart? As the heart doesn't fill up quite so much with volume, what happens to contractility of the heart? It decreases, right? So the stroke volume decreases, so cardiac output goes down. That has a tendency to decrease blood pressure. All right, ANP also promotes vasodilation. What happens to a pressure in some kind of vessel as it gets bigger? If the pressure decreases. That's an important law that we're going to look at in the next chapter, and that's the respiratory chapter. That's how fluid moves in and out of your lungs when you're breathing, right? And that fluid is air. All right, so these are a couple important slides that you should know. And then here probably is that nice exam figure that shows the mechanism in detail. All right, so AMP together with decreased antidiuretic hormone. All right, pretty good, pretty good, pretty good. And I don't know, is there like a little, maybe a scaling button we can push? Auto image. Should we try auto image? Yeah, that's really nice, because that's a nice bright projector. Okay, but I think that's pretty, it's a little bit big. I can't get the whole picture on there. But that's not bad. All right, so let's start with, so this is a nice response loop, right? So what does a response loop always start with?
Stimulus.
Some kind of stimulus, right. All right, so increased blood volume, right? Stretches the atria out. Thank you, Andy. And so increased blood volume causes increased venous return, so the heart fills up with more blood. So end-diastolic volume goes up as a result. That stretches the left atrium. And The left atrium releases atrial natriuretic peptide into the blood. It increases that secretion. This is one of the things that it does. We'll look at the second pathway in just a little bit. All right, and so AMP has an effect on the kidney by increasing sodium as well as water loss from your body. So that is going to increase urine volume. That's going to decrease blood volume. All right, and what's the effect of decreased blood volume? It's going to feed back negatively, right, to venous return, and so now the heart won't stretch out quite so much, and then this feedback loop disappears when the set point is reached. All right, when the atrium is stretching, there are also, the stretch receptors also send signals to the brain, so here's that afferent pathway to the medulla, all right, and then the medulla then sends signals to the hypothalamus, and then the hypothalamus sends signals to the posterior pituitary to decrease the amount of antidiuretic hormone that is released, all right, and so then that will have a tendency to decrease water reabsorption. And water reabsorption just means taking water out of basically urine or the precursor to urine and put it back in your cardiovascular system. So it's preventing the return of water that's lost in the kidneys back into your cardiovascular system, which does what? It increases urine volume, decreases blood volume, and again feeds back negatively to venous return to help maintain the proper blood volume in your body and therefore blood pressure. All right, so those are the three important hormones. So let's look at some factors affecting blood flow, and you've done at least one lab with this information already. All right, and so vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue or organ, and vasodilation decreases resistance a tremendous amount and increases blood flow. All right, vasoconstriction, on the other hand, does the opposite. It increases resistance and decreases blood flow. And I think you're kind of familiar with that Poiseuille's equation, okay, and we're going to get to that in just a second. All right, so here is just a nice slide that shows the distribution of cardiac output in people at rest. So look at where most of your blood is going. A tremendous amount, almost 20%, is going to the kidneys. That's a very, those are very small organs, but they're taking about 1/5 of the cardiac output. That's pretty amazing. The gastrointestinal tract is huge, right, and it receives about 25%. Skeletal muscles, when you're resting, just to maintain body posture and to maintain the health of joints and things like that, is about 20% again. And all other organs is only about 10%. The brain is about 13%. Okay, and that's pretty much constant. So that's kind of an interesting thing to look at. So let's look at the physical properties that describe how blood flows. Okay, and you could rely on a model of diffusion to understand how this works. So what's the main motive force for diffusion? Why is a molecule going to diffuse from one place to another? It's going to go according to what? Okay, well, I'm talking about diffusion. Not necessarily a fluid, but solutes in solution or particles that are in air, for instance. That was, I think, on test one, test two. Okay, yeah, concentration gradient, right? And which way will things automatically move? Yeah, from high concentration to low concentration, right? And as the concentration gradient disappears, right, in the two areas, as the concentration becomes similar, what happens to diffusion? Nothing happens, right? And as the concentration difference gets bigger and bigger, the rate of diffusion increases, right? Okay, so you're familiar with that. And that's pretty much the same situation that we have with flow of a fluid. It's going to be determined by a pressure difference between two locations. So a fluid like air or a liquid will move from one area to another according to a pressure gradient. And again, fluid is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. And as that pressure difference goes away, what happens to flow? It disappears as well, just like for diffusion. All right, so blood flows through the vascular system when there is a pressure difference that we call delta P at two ends of a blood vessel. Delta P is just P1 minus P2 right here. All right, and the flow rate is going to be directly proportional to this pressure difference. So as the pressure difference increases, what happens to blood flow? increases because that is what? That's the direct proportionality that we're interested in. All right, so here we have kind of an example of a heart. We got the left side of the heart, the right side of the heart, and the left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta, right? And it's a reciprocating pump, so you have a systolic pressure and a diastolic pressure. We can calculate the mean of that, and that's about 100 millimeters of mercury, so that's the mean pressure in the aorta right here. And then we can look at the pressure at the vena cava as it's entering the right atrium, and that mean pressure is going to be zero. It's going to be right at atmospheric pressure. That's what we mean by zero, atmospheric pressure. All right, so what's the pressure gradient? It's going to be 100 minus zero, or 100 millimeters of mercury. That's a pretty good pressure to move fluid through the cardiovascular system, all right? And I tell you what circulation are we looking at here? Which circulation? Remember, there are two. There are two circulations. Yeah, pulmonary and systemic, so which one are we looking at? Systemic, right? And so the systemic circulation has a really high pressure. The pulmonary circulation, since it only goes through the lungs, it's relatively low mean arterial pressure, right? But this is nice and high because it's the systemic circuit that we're looking at. Okay, so the flow rate not only is directly proportional, right, to a pressure difference on either end of a blood vessel, but it is also inversely related to something that's going to impede that flow, and that is the resistance of blood vessels. Right, so flow is equal to delta P divided by resistance, or the pressure gradient divided by resistance. And in lab, you had to learn what some of the things are that contribute to resistance in a blood vessel. One thing is the length of the blood vessel. As the blood vessel gets longer, what happens to resistance? It increases, right? Since it's directly related, as the blood vessel gets longer, the resistance increases, all right? And then furthermore, if this number in this flow relationship gets bigger, if R gets bigger, what happens to flow? What's the relationship between resistance and flow? Is it directly related or inversely? Inversely related. So when resistance goes up, what happens to flow? It goes down, right? So when the vessel length goes up, the flow goes down, right? So it's nice to be able to think of these things. All right, viscosity, our new right here, blood is fairly viscous. It's a lot more viscous than water is, and that's because it has a lot of cells. It has formed elements in there, which increase the viscosity of blood. And it is also, viscosity of blood is directly related to resistance. So as the viscosity of blood increases, what happens to flow? That's two steps. How about what happens to resistance as viscosity increases? It increases, right? So as viscosity increases, what happens to flow? It decreases, right? And athletes try to do that all the time, because what do red blood cells do for people? What's a good thing that they do for people? It delivers more oxygen to your tissues, right? And so athletes have a tendency to think that they'll be more competitive if they take erythropoietin shots, which boosts their hematocrit way up, because their blood can carry more oxygen, which is true, but there's something that's counteracting that beneficial effect that they want, and that is, as red blood cell volume increases, or as the hematocrit increases, so does the viscosity of blood. So the heart can't pump the same amount of blood, which then, what, reduces oxygen to the tissue. So that really does not help them very much. Okay. The last thing, in your body, does your body adjust the length of a blood vessel to regulate blood flow to it? No, you're same size, right? You don't get like as tall as this room right here to change flow through your body, all right? And there really are no major changes to the viscosity of blood either, because there's an optimal hematocrit, you know, right around 45%. So viscosity of blood under most circumstances doesn't change very much. But does your body adjust flow to different organs all the time? So there's got to be a parameter, right, by which your body can adjust flow to different organs, and this is it right here. And it is what? The radius of a blood vessel. And resistance is inversely proportional to the radius, but in a very special way. It's to the fourth power of the radius of a blood vessel, right? So as a blood vessel gets bigger, what happens, since it's inversely related to resistance, as a blood vessel gets bigger, what happens to resistance? it goes down, all right? And as resistance goes down, what happens to blood flow? It goes up, right? So as a blood vessel dilates, blood flow increases to that particular tissue. And that's how your body adjusts blood flow and matches blood flow to the needs of various tissues in your body. But more importantly, don't forget about how important this fourth power rule is, because, for instance, if the radius of a blood vessel were to increase by a factor of 2, what would be the increase in blood flow to an organ that's being supplied by that vessel? It would be what? 2 times 2 times 2 times 2. So what is that? 2 times 2 is 4. Times 2 is 8. Times 2 is 16. Right? So by small changes in the diameter of a blood vessel, there are huge changes in blood flow to various organs. So this is a very efficient mechanism for adjusting blood flow to various tissues. Yeah. What parameter? When the length increases, blood flow goes down. When the length of a vessel increases, the resistance goes up. And when resistance goes up, this is this term right here, blood flow goes down. Okay? But length of blood vessels is not really adjusted in your body. Like your arm doesn't get longer or shorter when you're using it, okay, to adjust the flow to that particular part of your body. Okay? Okay. So the most important parameter is what? The radius of a blood vessel. So the diameter of a vessel is very important for controlling resistance and therefore blood flow. So here is Poiseuille's equation that you're familiar with, right? So blood flow is equal to what? Delta P. That's the motive force. If there's no pressure gradient, then there's not going to be any blood flow. And then this last term over here, radius to the fourth power divided by nu, and then this L is the length of the blood vessel. What does this term relate to? This is relating to what? Resistance. All right, so resistance is equal to, maybe I'll write that down, what is resistance equal to? R is equal to that little funny Greek symbol, okay, because it kind of looks like that, and then the length of a blood vessel, right, divided by radius to the fourth power, that's resistance. Now where does this resistance go in Poiseuille's equation? All right, so we got blood flow is equal to, of course, delta P, divided by R. What the heck is that? Well, we got delta P divided by this new L divided by R to the fourth power. So L right here is in the denominator. What happens if you have a fraction in the denominator, right? And here's the denominator of the denominator. Where does that really belong? That really belongs in the numerator, right? So let's just kind of write it the way it should be, right? So we got delta P times radius to the fourth power, all right, divided by nu times the length of the blood vessel. And then we got a couple other constants right here that never change, like pi is just a number, 8 is just a number right here, just to match up these various measurements that we have, so that we have the correct length measurements, right, and viscosity measurements and P right here, so that this part of the equation makes sense. So this is just a proportionality constant that never ever changes. All right, so that's Poiseuille's equation right here. So is what happens to blood flow as the pressure gradient decreases? Blood flow decreases. What happens to blood flow when resistance increases? It decreases, right? Okay. And if we don't want to think about resistance, but we want to just think about the radius of a blood vessel, what happens to blood flow if the radius of a blood vessel increases? It increases in a big way. Why? Because the fourth power rule. That's right. That makes a huge difference right there. All right, so that's Poiseuille's equation again, and a little bit of a discussion about it. All right, so here is a nice graph. What are we looking at in this graph right here? What are the axes? We have pressure versus what that pressure looks like in different parts of the cardiovascular system. All right, so as blood moves from one part of the cardiovascular system to the other, right, we can see what the pressure looks like. And so here is pressure, maximum is 120, and then the minimum is 0, right? And the first part of the graph shows it in the left ventricle, and you're kind of familiar with this because you had the Wiggers diagram on that last test, and this was on that diagram. So 120 represents what? Yeah? Systolic pressure, right? That's kind of like at the end of systole, so that's a systolic pressure in the left ventricle. Oh, that's not quite at the end of systole. That's in the middle of systole right here. All right, and then the ventricle pressure in the ventricle goes all the way down to zero during diastole, and then at another time, the ventricle contracts and it shoots way up to 120 again, right? So that's just the pressure that we see in the left ventricle. And when the left ventricle contracts, that's forcing blood into the aorta and all the rest of the large arteries, and we can see a systolic and diastolic pressure in these arteries, all right? And it's pulsatile because of the contraction of the heart. And as blood moves into smaller arteries and arterioles, right, this pressure pulse disappears, right? The systolic and diastolic kind of merge together, but also the mean pressure starts to decrease, right? Because what's happening to resistance in these blood vessels right here? What's the difference in the radius between the aorta and small arteries? It gets smaller. So as the radius decreases, what happens to resistance? The resistance increases, right? And so that's going to decrease pressure in these blood vessels. So these vessels right here, we call resistance vessels, and they can actually change their radius to a large degree to accommodate different metabolic demands of different tissues. Okay, and then in the capillaries, there's a little bit of a pressure decrease, and venules, there's a little bit of a pressure decrease because there's resistance in these blood vessels. And then finally, blood returns to the heart. And these large veins right here and venules are what we call capacitance vessels because they can change their diameter a large degree and hold a lot of blood, right, and actually prevent it from returning to the right atrium to be pumped by the heart. So it kind of acts as a reservoir for blood in case you ever need to boost your blood pressure up in a hurry. Then these vessels can constrict and return a lot of blood to the heart. Okay, and so your body uses this mechanism right here, the resistance in small arterioles and arteries, to take blood from one organ and redistribute it to another organ, right? And that's why your mom said, as you were a little kid, you can't go swimming right after lunch because you don't have enough blood to go everywhere in your body, right? So after lunch, where is blood being shunted to? Yeah, your gastrointestinal tract. And if you're in a quiet state, that's fine, all right? But if you become very active, like swimming, where is blood going to want to go as well? To muscles, because of local control, those blood vessels are going to dilate, take blood away from your gastrointestinal tract, which might cause cramps, right? And if you're in a swimming pool or something, you might not be able to keep your head above water if that happens, right? So that would be a nasty thing. Okay, so what blood vessels have the highest blood pressure? Okay, so large arteries, very good. And what blood vessels have the lowest blood pressure? And unless you know how to read this graph, students always say it the wrong way because they're familiar with one of the most important functioning parts of the cardiovascular system, and that's where exchange takes place, all right? And where does exchange take place? And it's the only place where exchange can take place, capillaries, right? So a lot of students have a tendency to say, just because capillaries are like the most functional in terms of significance, that the capillaries have the lowest blood pressure. All right, but don't kind of fall into that trap, all right, because if capillaries had the lowest blood pressure, where would all the blood be going?
Capillaries.
Into capillaries, right? So blood in veins would flow into capillaries, blood in arteries would flow into capillaries, and eventually it would be a big mess, right? Because capillaries would expand and blow up and it would be a mess, right? So the lowest blood vessel is in the veins closest to the heart, so it returns to the heart. Yeah. Okay, but there is something important about capillaries, though, however, and that's shown on this particular slide right here. We've got a couple plots, right? And let's not talk about the vertical axis. Let's look at the horizontal axis once again. And the horizontal axis right here is just, again, different locations within the cardiovascular system, starting not with the ventricle in this case, but the aorta, and arteries, and really, really small arteries called arterioles, capillaries, venules, veins, and then the vena cava. And let's look at the cross-sectional area. If we were to add the cross-sectional area of all of these blood vessels up at one particular location and measure it, right, we would get the cross-sectional area, which is what? It's just the width times the height multiplied together, right, to get the surface area of that particular blood vessel. So it's not a volume, it's just a two-dimensional measurement of the cross-sectional area. So what would be the cross-sectional area of this piece of paper right here? 8.5 inches by 11. Multiply them together, okay? So by measuring that in these different locations, we see that the cross-sectional area in the aorta is relatively small. Right, it's a big artery, right, compared to other arteries, but how many do you have? You only got one measly aorta, right? So the cross-sectional area is small. And as the blood moves from the aorta into smaller arterioles, of course the radius or the diameter of each one of these blood vessels decreases, but now how many do you have? Oh, yeah, you have millions of them, right? So even though their cross-sectional area is small, you have to add them all up together. So the cross-sectional area increases, it skyrockets. And of course, by the time you get to a capillary right here, each capillary is microscopically small, but how many do you have? Well, I don't even know. I said millions for arterioles. Well, then you probably have billions of capillaries, right, that you have to multiply that all together. So the cross-sectional area goes way up, and then as these blood vessels anastomose into venules, the total cross-sectional area goes down once again. Okay, so if you have the same amount of flow going through the aorta and the same flow, blood flow back into the heart via the vena cava right here, what happens to the velocity of this blood as the cross-sectional area changes? That's what we want to look at. So there's a difference between blood flow, which is what? A volume per time versus what we're looking at here. Velocity, what is velocity? It is just a distance per time, like you would read on your speedometer, for instance. So on your speedometer, you don't have volume per time, you just have distance per time, right? So a speed or velocity is a distance per time, and has nothing to do with the flow through there. So if we look at these various vessels, which blood vessels have the smallest velocity? Or the slowest velocity? It is capillaries right here. And that's because capillaries have the highest cross-sectional area. So the same amount of blood is flowing through a capillary compared to the aorta and the vena cava, but because the cross-sectional area is so huge, it has to slow down when it's going through all those billions of blood vessels. And of course, that's really important. So another question is, what blood vessels have the slowest velocity? Now here you want to say, capillaries, right? And why is that? And that's because you have so many of them, the cross-sectional area adds up in a big way, right? And now why is that important? Now you can rely on your understanding from anatomy about a capillary as being exchange takes place there. So you don't want blood rushing through a capillary because you don't have time for exchange. Right, so the longer the time blood has in a capillary, the more efficient the exchange mechanisms can be. And that's just because there are so many capillaries, the blood velocity decreases. Okay, blood pressure. I think this is one of the last topics in this particular chapter. And we've talked about it a little bit. All right, so we say that arterioles play a role in distributing blood and controlling blood pressure. Because there's a special property of arterioles. What can they do? Okay, what can an arteriole do? What's a very efficient way of controlling blood flow? Okay, so here we have blood flow. It's equal to what? The pressure gradient divided by resistance. What's a very important term in resistance? It is the radius right here. So arterioles are really important because they can vasoconstrict and vasodilate. Right, those are what we call distributing arteries because they can vasoconstrict and vasodilate. All right, so blood flow to capillaries and blood pressure is controlled by the aperture of arterioles that feed those particular capillary beds. Okay, so capillary blood pressure is decreased because they're downstream from high resistance arterioles. So here we have just a little tube system, and I guess it's made out of plastic because we can take this little thumb screw and put it in different locations, right, and cause a constriction of this tube right here. All right, so we see that as the height of this fluid increases, what happens to pressure right here as the height of this fluid increases? As we put more and more fluid in here, the pressure is going to decrease, right? So, I mean, if you lie down on the ground and we have somebody sit on you that's heavy, okay, and then if we put two people on you, it's what? Really heavy, and if we put three people on you, then it's super heavy, right? So the more blood in terms of height in this tube right here means more pressure. And what do we need for flow? What's going to determine flow? Yeah, the pressure. So as we increase the pressure, that's going to force blood through this system right here. Okay. So if we maintain a certain pressure, just a constant pressure, blood is going to want to flow into this particular part of the tube. And if we put a constriction right here, what can you tell me about flow past this constriction? It's going to decrease. Oh, you know what? Yeah, thank you so much. All the excitement with the projectors, I forgot that one. Okay, so if we put a constriction right here, right, there's going to be a big resistance in this location, so there's going to be a huge pressure drop across this area, so now we have relatively low pressure because above this little thumb screw there's high pressure. The resistance eats up a lot of pressure, so we have very low pressure. So what's the height of fluid in this tube right here? It's going to be relatively small because there's hardly any pressure in this part of the tube, right? But because of this resistance here, that maintains pressure in this region and this region right here, so now we're going to have what? Relatively high fluid levels in these two blood circuits. Now, what's going to happen to these two, what's going to happen to the pressure in these two circuits if we were to take this thumb screw away? Yeah, it's going to, yeah, so that's just kind of an intuitive feeling that you should have, right? As this resistance goes away, you're going to have a lot more blood flow through this part of the tube, and the height of blood in these tubes is going to decrease. So that's what your body does, right? It can pick what parts of the circulation should receive blood flow by vasodilating or vasoconstricting various arterioles all over your body. That's like putting thumb screws in different parts of this little device that we have right here. Okay, so who's got a question with that? It's just an intuitive feeling that you should have with this. All right, or if we put a constriction right here, right, then the height of fluid in all three of these tubes is going to decrease. Okay, so let's see if we can come up with some reasons why that is. All right, so capillary blood flow is low because of a large cross-sectional area. So here we see a cross-sectional area again of what? Capillaries in this region right here, and right, that shows a decrease in pressure across capillaries. All right, so let's determine blood pressure. All right, the good equation for blood pressure. So blood pressure is controlled by heart rate and stroke volume and resistance, right, peripheral resistance. And what is resistance going to be determined by in your body, primarily? It's the length of a blood vessel, viscosity, but what's the thing that's actively regulated? It is, yeah, the radius of a blood vessel right here. All right, so that's going to determine blood pressure. An increase in any of these can result in increased blood pressure. Now, this is not intuitive. Okay, maybe somebody can see that it is intuitive. So let's kind of work this out. So here we have blood flow. Maybe I'll erase this part right here. All right, I'll erase this part right here. All right, so one of the basic equations is blood flow is equal to what? The pressure gradient divided by resistance. And this could be the total peripheral resistance in your body, all right, to blood flow. But what else do we know what blood flow is equal to? Hey, look at this right here. Cardiac output is equal to what? stroke volume times heart rate. That's a blood flow. All right, so we got blood flow right here. So delta P over R is equal to, let's just bring that down, stroke volume, right, times heart rate. And then we could be really kind of sneaky, okay, and do some algebra. And let's put this R up in the numerator, because right now it's in the denominator. What do we have to do? Multiply both sides of the equation by R, and what do we get? Delta P, or what? Blood pressure. All right, so I'm just going to put blood pressure right here is going to equal stroke volume times heart rate times what? Resistance. And the resistance that we're talking about right now in the book or in physiology, we could just call it total peripheral resistance, or TPR. That's what I have here. Oh, peripheral resistance. Peripheral resistance or total peripheral resistance are the same term. If you want to erase that T, that's fine with me. So we've got this nice equation right here, blood pressure. Do you all kind of see how we derive that? It's not really difficult, okay? Blood pressure is equal to stroke volume. That's the contractility of the heart, how fast the heart is beating, right? So we got an inotropic parameter here. We got a chronotropic parameter here, but we also have resistance, which pretty much is determined by what? The radius of blood vessels in the body. Okay. And what's the relationship of all three of these parameters to blood pressure? You could say what? Inversely proportional or directly proportional? Inversely related or directly related? They're all directly related, right? So if resistance goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. If heart rate goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. If contractility increases, blood pressure goes up. Right, so here is an equation. If you don't want to derive it, just memorize it. Okay, and it's not that hard because these things are just directly related to each other. Okay, so that's what this statement right here says. An increase in any of these can result in increased blood pressure, and that makes perfect sense because all those parameters are what? Directly related to each other. All right, so sympathoadrenal activity raises blood pressure via arterial vasoconstriction, okay, by increased cardiac output. Well, let's think of this first one right here. Sympathoadrenal activity raises blood pressure by arterial vasoconstriction. What happens to resistance in a blood vessel when it vasoconstricts? Resistance goes up. When resistance goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up too. Nothing too special about that, right? That just falls out really, really easy. What about increasing cardiac output? Well, sympathoadrenal activity increases heart rate, right? Increases stroke volume, right? So that is going to increase blood pressure as well. So sympathetic effects increase resistance, increase heart rate, increase stroke volume, can increase blood pressure in a really big way. Okay, so small changes in sympathetic tone can have major effects on blood pressure. All right, kidney plays a role in blood pressure by regulating blood volume and thus stroke volume. What's the relationship between blood volume and stroke volume? How do you get from blood volume to stroke volume? Okay, blood volume, as your blood volume goes up, what happens to venous return? As you have more blood, okay, yeah, venous return increases. What happens to the heart as more blood is flowing back to it? Starts to stretch, and then what happens to the ventricle? Does it get stronger or stay the same? Yeah, it does, because of the Frank-Starling law, right? So stroke volume increases, okay, and so blood pressure is increased. So kidneys play a big role in blood pressure by regulating blood volume via what? The Frank-Starling law that increases stroke volume. So with stroke volume increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases as well. So that's why those things work hand in hand and are pretty nifty. Okay, so this is going to take us to another mechanism, which is just as important as the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. And what could you tell me about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism? Why is it important? Because what's it regulating? Yeah, it's regulating water retention and sodium and all that kind of stuff. But the overall cardiovascular parameter I want you just to immediately think about is blood pressure. Okay, and how important is it for regulating blood pressure? Number one, mechanism for what? Regulating blood pressure in the long term. Okay, day to day, not minute to minute, second to second, but over the long term, right? Week to week, something like that. All right, now your blood pressure can fluctuate very rapidly from second to second. And if your blood pressure is rapidly changing due to change in body position, like right now if you were to stand up, your blood pressure drops, can you afford to wait around a week for your blood pressure to come back up via the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism? No, because you might pass out, right, and your head's going to bounce off the table, and then it's going to bounce off the chair, and then it's going to bounce off the floor, right, a really big mess. So you need something that will operate fast, and that is what? The baroreceptor reflex. So there are two mechanisms for regulating blood pressure. One is long-term, which is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. For short-term regulation is the baroreceptor reflex. And you're all aware that nervous reflexes are faster, right, compared to hormonal reflexes, right? They don't last as long, but they can operate much more quickly. All right, so baroreceptor reflex is activated by changes in blood pressure. That's the stimulus. All right, changes in blood pressure are detected by pressure receptors. And baro just means what? Pressure. That's just somebody that's studied pressure, the physics of pressure long ago. I don't know if it was a senor or senorita Barr. I'm not sure who that was, but that was their last name, okay? And these are just stretch receptors. As blood pressure increases in the aortic arch, guess what happens to the shape of the arch? It increases, right? So it stretches, and those stretch receptors increase the number of action potentials that are sent to the brain, right? So the brain knows that there's a higher pressure in the aorta, as well as the carotid sinus. Who knows where the carotid sinus is? It's probably one of the most commonly imaged parts in the human body with ultrasound. Where's that carotid sinus at? Okay, it's near the carotid artery. So here you have the common carotid coming up, right? And then it's going to bifurcate into internal and external. And right at that bifurcation is the carotid sinus. There's a little bulge in that area, and there are pressure receptors. So we could really mess with your blood pressure if I was to come over and squeeze your neck right there because those baroreceptors are being stimulated, okay? And so your brain thinks your blood pressure is skyrocketing. What's it going to do? It's going to try to bring it back down, okay? So you might pass out. That's kind of the basis of a sleep hold in wrestling, right? Okay, yeah, the sleeper hold. Okay, so increase in blood pressure causes the walls of these regions to stretch, increasing the frequency of action potentials to the brain. All right, and so that sends information to the medulla oblongata. That's where the cardioregulatory center and the vasomotor center is located. Your book has a tendency to call that the cardiac control center. Okay, that's okay with me, but nonetheless, it's in the medulla. And the baroreceptor reflex is most sensitive to a decrease, right, and especially sudden changes in blood pressure. Because if your blood pressure were to suddenly decrease, what would happen to blood flow, especially to your brain? Okay? If the pressure decreases, what happens to blood flow? It decreases, right? And so you might pass out. So this is an important mechanism when you're changing body position. All right, so here it is in a nice graphical way. We see the aortic arch. There's that little baroreceptor. Here's the carotid sinus. Here's that bulge. I didn't realize I had this picture in here. That's a nice picture, right? The internal and external carotid. And there are pressure receptors right here. Send signals to the medulla, the cardioregulatory center. Now, what's in the medulla right here? It's got what? Right? This is the integration center. It's going to compare information coming from the periphery to what? Set point. Yeah, it's going to compare information to a set point, which is what? Your normal body pressure or blood pressure, what it should be. And if there's an error, then the integration center has got to make a decision on what to do if there's an error. Okay, and I think this is the vagus nerve and this is the hypoglossal nerve right here. So the vasomotor center, let's just say blood pressure is decreasing. What kind of decision do you think the vasomotor center and cardioregulatory center want to make if your blood pressure is decreasing? Okay, it's going to send signals out through which nervous system, parasympathetic or sympathetic? Sympathetic nervous system. All right, so it's going to send some information out, right, through the nice sympathetic chain ganglia here to the SA node and AV node. And what's that effect going to be? Increase heart rate, so it's going to be a positive chronotropic effect. It's going to increase stroke volume, increase heart rate. What's going to happen to blood pressure as a result? It's going to increase, which is what? The same as the stimulus or opposite? It subtracts from the stimulus, so that's a nice negative control mechanism. All right. But not only does the sympathetic nerve go to the SA node and AV node, it also goes to the myocardium, ventricular myocardium, increases force of contraction. Remember that curve? We had a couple curves. What happens to force of contraction as we increase sympathetic tone on the heart? It gets stronger. That's a couple slides back. So as the contractility increases, all right, which one of these parameters change as the heart gets stronger? Stroke volume goes up, right? Stroke volume goes up. What happens to blood pressure? It goes up as well. One last thing that's not on this slide right here. There are also sympathetic nerves that go to arterioles. What is the effect of sympathetic stimulation on most arterioles? It causes, okay, constriction in most arterioles. Some in muscle, there's some muscles that dilate with sympathetic stimulation, but most arterioles constrict. And as arterioles constrict, what happens to resistance? Resistance goes up, and so what happens to blood pressure? Because resistance increases, so does blood pressure. So sympathetic tone increases stroke volume, increases heart rate, increases resistance, and so blood pressure goes up, which counteracts that initial stimulus. Baroreceptor can work in the opposite way as well, right? If blood pressure goes too high, instead of sending signals out through the sympathetic system, it can send it out through the parasympathetic system to do what? Decrease heart rate. But that's pretty much the only choice the cardioregulatory center has. It only can adjust the chronotropy on the heart, can't adjust peripheral resistance, can't adjust stroke volume right here. So most mechanisms in your body have one effect on blood pressure, which is what? Increasing it, not very many antagonistic mechanisms for decreasing it, and that's probably one reason why hypertension is such a prevalent disease, right? Because it's not a very balanced system. All right, so I think, is that the last? Oh, here it is. Baroreceptor reflex. Another nice, really good exam figure without the graphic of the heart and the medulla in there. So we're going to change body position, going from a lying down position to a standing position. All right, blood is going to want to pool in extremities when that happens, when you change body position like that. So as blood pools in your extremities, what about return to the heart? It decreases, right? And as venous return decreases, the end diastolic volume decreases, what happens to contractility? By the Frank-Starling law, contractility decreases, so stroke volume goes down. What happens to blood pressure when stroke volume goes down? It decreases, right? Including, oh, so cardiac output goes down, blood pressure decreases, less blood goes to your brain, which could be really dangerous. So here is the stimulus, right? A decrease in blood pressure, but that's okay because you have the baroreceptor reflex. The pressure receptors, where are these located? The aortic arch and the carotid sinus have baroreceptors. Then the afferent pathways take it to the medulla oblongata, right, which has the set point, makes a decision on what to do. What was the initial stimulus? Decreased blood pressure. All right, so the decision then, all right, does it make sense? Does the decision mean increase sympathetic activity? Yeah, and what? Decrease parasympathetic. All right, so let's see. Some of this goes to blood vessels to cause vasoconstriction. That increases total peripheral resistance. All right. What happens to blood pressure when resistance goes up? It increases, right? When sympathetic tone to the heart goes up, then cardiac rate goes up, right? So that's a chronotropic effect. What happens to blood pressure? Increases. And you know what? They should have another little sidebar over here, another arrow. What would that other arrow be? It's not in your book, so I'm not going to test you on it, but you should probably appreciate it's there. Not only does sympathetic tone affect chronotropy of the heart, it affects what? Inotropy. So there should be another arrow here going to stroke volume, increasing stroke volume, right, which will increase blood pressure as well. All right, so, and that increase in blood pressure counteracts the initial stimulus, so that's a nice negative feedback loop. All right, so I don't know, we kind of beat that one pretty well. Who's got a question about that? Can you follow it? I think it's really easy to follow as long as you know what? Blood pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times resistance. All right, and what's stroke volume times heart rate? That's just cardiac output. Okay, so you should be able to find your way around that pretty easily. So that's it for this particular chapter. Okay. So we should be starting respiratory system today, which we can. Which we can, if I can figure out how to get rid of these things all over the place. How do I make this go away? Oh, I hit it. I was lucky. All right, so I'm going to start respiratory, probably not get very far with respiratory system. Maybe we're just going to have to review some anatomy. All right, so that's chapter 16. So we're going to look at some respiratory structures, some physical aspects of ventilation, mechanics. Oh yeah, these are all really good things. Okay, so when we say respiration, right, it means usually about four different things, and these can be a little confusing. Hi. Okay. Let's see, this is what? What chapter was this? 16? That must be, that doesn't pertain to this class. No, I don't think you even have those chapters. Well, I'll have to check. I'll have to see how those got in there. I don't know how they got in there. Okay, I'll hide them. That might correspond to Merib or something. Okay? Yeah. Well, you have to come to class to find out. Okay? It's for sure going to be what? It's going to be 14, 16, 17, maybe a little part of digestion and diversification system. So you have to keep coming to class to know. I don't mean to do that just so that you come to class. It's too far in the future for me to know. Okay? Okay, so let's just focus on respiration for a couple minutes. Just a couple minutes. All right, so there are actually four related functions that relate to respiration, and that is ventilation. That just means moving air in and out of your body, breathing. All right, so air is a fluid. It's going to flow in your body due to what? Pressure gradient, right? Air is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure, so we're going to see how your body changes the pressure inside the lungs so that air flows in and changes the pressure again so air flows out. Okay. Respiration can also mean gas exchange. All right, now where is gas exchanging in your body? In your lungs, anywhere where there is a capillary. How many circuits in your circulation have capillaries? You have the pulmonary, yeah, there's two. You got the pulmonary circulation and the systemic circulation, right? So that's why I say there's four related functions right here. One is gas exchange in the lungs. That's very important. Capillaries in the pulmonary capillaries. But we also have to be interested in gas exchange in the systemic circulation as well. So gas exchange in those two places, as well as oxygen utilization. We just call that cellular respiration, and we spent, I don't know how many weeks on that in this class. Maybe, for sure, two, maybe three. Where does that happen? Cellular respiration. Yeah, in the cell. What part of the cell in particular? How about mitochondria? Okay, because oxygen is necessary to keep the electron transport chain working just right? That's what produces most of the ATP in your body. Okay, so those are the things that you have to keep in the back of your mind. Ventilation just moves air in and out of your lungs, right? Sometimes people call that external respiration, right? Gas exchange between blood and tissues and vice versa is what? Internal respiration. And gas exchange is always passive, right? And a passive just means what?
Without ATP,
something is going to move from high concentration to low concentration. So the concentration gradient is going to be the motive force, and it's not going to be dependent on ATP, and we just call that diffusion. It's not even facilitated diffusion. It's just diffusion. So oxygen and CO2 can move across cell membranes very easily. Right? They can move through. So if a mitochondria needs oxygen, and the only way that oxygen can get to a mitochondria, what about the concentration of oxygen at a mitochondria compared to in the air? Where is it the lowest? In the mitochondria, which is kind of counterintuitive because you think oxygen should be high inside the mitochondria. But in reality, it's not, because if oxygen was high at a mitochondria compared to the air, which way would oxygen move? Away from the mitochondria into the air, right? So oxygen is moving from the air into your tissues and mitochondria. And of course, they use it up and produce CO2. The concentration of CO2 in the air is almost zero. It's extremely low. It's high in your tissues, and so there's a big concentration gradient to release it from your tissues as a result. Okay, so here's a nice picture of your lungs, right? Nice trachea. All right, and then we got a primary bronchiole. Primary bronchioles bifurcate into secondary bronchioles, right? The diameter gets smaller and smaller and smaller until finally we get into bronchioles. All of these structures have cartilage on them, and that cartilage holds these structures open. Because when there are pressure changes in your thorax, right, in order to exhale, the pressure inside your lungs has to increase, and that pressure increase could actually collapse these tubes right here, and if they collapse, then no air could flow through them, right? Okay, so cartilage is holding these tubes open all the time. Now, when you get into these bronchioles, there's no cartilage. And so these tubes actually can change their diameter. And from the cardiovascular system, when the radius of these tubes changes, what happens to airflow through them? What determines the flow? Yeah, Poiseuille's equation, right? So small changes in the radius of this bronchiole right here can make big changes in airflow through different parts of the lung as well. Okay. So bronchioles don't have cartilage. We've got terminal bronchioles that feed respiratory bronchioles, and some respiratory bronchioles have these little pouches on them that we call alveoli. And I might just have to cancel lecture here because I'm coughing for some reason. Okay. So the structural and functional unit of gas exchange in the lung is this alveolus. And so I think that's where we're going to start next time. So I'm going to cut lecture short by about 2 minutes and go cough someplace. All right. So we're going to start probably right here next time. Yeah, I'm fine. I was talking too loud. Hey.
You always make lecture when I
come out. Oh, good. Good, good, good. I'm glad you come.
Yeah. How often do you update the lectures online?
Usually on the weekend.
Okay.
Friday, Saturday.